I'm very pleased to be here and also very interested in learning about the Urantia book. Steve lent me a copy with the accompanying volume, which is helpful. And I've begun to go through it. And I hope, Steve, that you'll let me keep it a little bit longer because I want to spend a good bit of time with it. It's not the sort of thing that I would ever want to try to read hastily, any more than any other scripture. And it's something that I can see already that one has to live with because it's the sort of book that you not only read, but it reads you after a certain point. And that's one of the things that is a mark of Holy Scripture in the traditions that I'm familiar with. I have an awfully big schedule here tonight, but I hope that you will not be too overwhelmed by the number of facts that I've put down on the outline. I thought that some of the more detailed statements that I've made would help you retain some of the material if it's new to you. I don't know what the background of the group is. I always like to start out talking about the Near Eastern context, but when I say the word Near Eastern, I'm immediately confronted with something of an intellectual as well as perhaps a moral and cultural problem. The Near East and Arabia, as you see here, well, Arabia is usually part of the Near East, but what does Near East mean? Near East is a Western term. It's a relative term. The Middle East is a relative term. Near to whom? East to whom? I had a professor whose passing was lamented by many who used to look at National Geographic maps and turn into a purple rage because he thought they were racist. Generally, the world maps in the National Geographic, and certainly when I was growing up, always had the Western Hemisphere right in the middle, and then over on the periphery, Europe on one side and East Asia on the other, and then some sort of Siberia, but everything was all squinched into the sides, and the United States was always right in the middle. And of course, the notion Near East is in relation to the old colonial European powers, France and England especially, and I suppose by extension, the United States. My professor liked to speak of this Near East as the Nile to Oxus region, preferring to be precisely geographical in his references, which has no invidious or comparative dimension to it. So the Nile to Oxus would be this region to this region up here in Central Asia. The Oxus would be the name of the river up there when Alexander was moving through all of this region in his campaigns. Then this area from here over, and I don't have all that I need on the map, to the Atlantic, including Spain within Islamic civilization, would be called the West. You see, that's their reference. They called it the West. And it's called the Maghrib, Maghrib, which simply means the sunset, which is a beautiful way of speaking of the West. And then, of course, we move on from here into the farther Middle East. We could call it, I suppose, but really South Asia, into India. I'll talk about the demographics of Islam later on tonight and to some extent tomorrow as well. But civilization was achieved in this part of the world, first in Mesopotamia, but really throughout the Fertile Crescent. If you want to look at it, you can describe a kind of new moon here, as it was described by James Breasted, the American Egyptologist, earlier in this century, the Fertile Crescent. Mesopotamia, Canaan, and the Nile Delta, and then, of course, by extension, the Nile Valley. Civilization and what the anthropologists like to call state-grade societies were achieved in these areas, beginning in the fourth millennium before Christ, 6,000 years ago, roughly. Of course, town life and domestication of animals was much earlier in this area here and also in the Jericho area. And we're pushing that back more and more now. It's very fascinating to me that in nuclear physics and in astronomy and so forth, we are pushing the frontiers farther and farther, but we're also pushing the frontiers into the past much further. so that we're learning more each year about how far back we go as well. Now, one of the main aspects of communal life as civilization with its hierarchies, its complex interdependence, and its spiritual disciplines, one of the main elements seems to have been a tremendous thirsting for justice. We can find that in commercial records, among other things, because commerce needs some sort of stable moral environment, some sort of stable pattern in order to be profitable, but also to be endurable and to be sustainable over vast distances. So one of the things that we will find in Islam is a tremendous yearning for social justice, for economic justice, and political balance. And this I can see going way back into the pre-Abrahamic past of the Fertile Crescent. I'm not saying that it cannot be found in other parts of the world, but for our interests here tonight, we are looking at the Near Eastern past and also, more specifically, the Abrahamic past. What sort of lives can we characterize from the religious point of view, let's say in Pharaonic Egypt, when the kingdoms of Upper, meaning the Southern, and Lower Egypt were finally combined, perhaps a bit before 3000 BC. Or in Mesopotamia under the Sumerians in the 3000s and later under the Babylonian Semitic empires. It seems that we can characterize the two as rather different from each other. Now, both were complex civilizations. Both achieved writing early, although Egypt certainly got it from Mesopotamia, which achieved it first. Both started out with monumental architecture, although Egypt was unique in having monumental stone architecture, which is why we know so much about Egypt. In some ways, we know more about ancient Egypt than we know about ancient Mesopotamia because of the enduring qualities of stone and the writing on stone and the funerary complexes that are familiar to us. Egypt was blessed by, and still is to some extent, although the dam here has changed things a great deal, was blessed by fairly stable cycles of agricultural life. The inundation of the Nile was fairly regular each year. The Egyptians thought that Osiris caused the rising of the water and the coming of the green new crops each year. We know that it was the rains of Central Africa and still is to some extent, although the dam, the Aswan Dam, has changed all of this very much. The river flows north and the wind blows south. What you've got is free hydraulic power and wind power. That is, goods can move floating downstream and they can sail upstream. This is one of the crucial natural ecological factors that enabled intelligent individuals and groups and tribes and clans to achieve a remarkable uniformity of civilization fairly early. Although the types of people from here to the sea are rather different than from here to here. The northern or the upstreamers, the upper Egyptians, tend to be more passionate, more ferocious, more macho, and short-tempered, and magnificent in their own way. And these people tend to be more easygoing, a little bit more slow, more Mediterranean, perhaps more stolid. But there was always among both upper and lower Egyptians a fair amount of optimism and a sense that to be Egyptian was to be really human, to enjoy the best that the cosmos has to offer. Egyptians have always dreaded the possibility of dying away from home. Death is very important to the Egyptians, as it is to all of us, but as we know, it was worked into a magnificent continuation with all of the symbols of familiarity and of reassurance and of justice that can be seen in the art. So there was a sense that the Egyptians were singularly blessed by the gods. And it was believed that Pharaoh himself was God over Egypt. And therefore, Pharaoh provided a point at which the gods and the humans identified with each other. So there was what John Wilson, the late Egyptologist at the University of Chicago, used to call a sense of a consubstantial universe, that we and animals and the water and the air and the sun are all part of one vast substratum of substance, that we are not different as humans, essentially, from animals, from the stars, and from other things. We have different roles, we have different types of consciousness. There was a great sense of optimism then, a great sense of balance, a great sense of justice. If the people cooperated with the natural elements, the goddess Maat, M-A-A-T, is often depicted in the art with a feather on her head and a set of scales. It's probably one of the earliest examples we have of the Lady Justice with the scales of good and evil, of deeds. It was quite different in Mesopotamia, where also there was a hydraulic civilization, meaning a very intricate network of irrigation and transportation on the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. But the weather in Mesopotamia never cooperated quite as much as it did in Egypt, and the winters could be terribly cold and destructive, and the summers drought-prone with sandstorms, and oftentimes no food. There developed a sense of pessimism, I would call it, in Mesopotamia, but also a sense of realism and a hardiness. Not only was the natural environment capricious, often very beneficial, but capricious, but this is really a crossroads of civilization in a way that Egypt never was quite. Egypt is important, certainly, but more isolated, and in fact, able to defend itself and to be self-contained in this great valley. Here, however, you have contending groups from all around who desired this very rich Mesopotamian area for its riches of agriculture and of transportation and of what you might call just fulcral point control. So it required unusually able groupings of people to hang on to that area. I would say that in terms of Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, there are probably greater influences to a certain extent from here than from here. Here also is an area not only first in writing, but also first in the world, so far as we know, in codified law. A codified law was achieved under Hammurabi about the same time as Abraham lived. Now, Abraham was a pastoralist, was not really in the mainstream of the high civilizational life that we found in the cities here. But codified law under Hammurabi, and from that time on, and you may well know that there are many examples in the book of Leviticus and in Exodus of parallels with the code of Hammurabi and earlier law, which are perhaps 900, 800, 900,000 years before the book of Leviticus in the Old Testament was in the form that we know it, at least now. Also, the ancient Egyptians believed in an afterlife, not a resurrection really, but an afterlife across the river in the land of the Westerners, the sunset area. But the Mesopotamians didn't. There was a remarkable story called the Story of Gilgamesh, where Gilgamesh, a very remarkable, heroic young man, was with his friend, and they were traveling about the countryside and wondering about the mystery of life, and he lost his friend. His friend died, and Gilgamesh was overwhelmed by grief and wondered what the secret of eternal life was, and found it, and it was a weed, and he went to an old sage and got that secret from Utnapishtim. But he laid it down at one point, and a snake came along and ate the weed, so they lost the secret of eternal life. And then he realized that this life is just one damn thing after another. Kind of an early existentialist, one who said that we must, after all, live, as Camus put it, without appeal. We must make it ourselves. We must derive and develop our own meaning and live courageously. So I would say that there are real antecedents to modern thinking there, and we don't find it quite so much. It wasn't that Egypt was static. It was quite stable and quite conservative. There's a wonderful poem by Randall Jarrell, where he speaks of a little bird that's sitting on a twig outside the window where the wife is doing the dishes after supper. And this little bird is saying, "May tomorrow be like today." And I think that the Egyptian prayed, like the little bird of Randall Jarrell, that tomorrow should be like today, because they wanted abidingness. They wanted this sense of stability and of sameness, because it's so reassuring. In the face of periods when life was anything but reassuring, but there was this yearning for this. I would say that the Mesopotamian was perhaps a bit more daring, and I would say that the Hebrew, who really comes out of that environment, but from the fringes of the environment, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joshua and Moses, would pray, "May tomorrow be what God brings." So there's a kind of an openness to the future, which I think developed in the Hebraic consciousness, which we don't find quite in the great civilizations of the Fertile Crescent to that time. Henri Frankfort, in his remarkable essay, which he wrote with Mrs. Frankfort in the book Before Philosophy, also known as The Intellectual Adventure of Ancient Man, published at Chicago in 1946, said that the Hebrew, coming out of this area particularly and moving into Canaan, a similar area, gained his freedom at the loss, or with the loss, of significant form. That is, there was a great deal of form both in Egypt, in the hieratic, the priestly structure, the governmental structure, the funerary rituals, and in Mesopotamia as well, where the king was sacral, although not divine. The pharaoh was divine, but the king in Mesopotamia was at the top of the human pyramid, you might say, ziggurat, and had to give an annual report every year, often to an angry group of gods who watched from on high in their court and ran the earth like some great fief, with the king as the vessel. The Hebrews opted out of that sort of thing and moved, but they lost significant form, but they learned about history. They learned about movement through time, and that meaning may come in the critical events which follow upon decision-making. So newness is there. Not Randall Jarrell's little bird who prays that tomorrow will be like today, but may tomorrow be what God brings. Now, this leads us to the whole notion of Abrahamic, and I would assume that you're familiar with the outlines of this. It's very important, in my opinion, when coming to study Islam anywhere in the world, but especially in a Christian or Jewish environment, to understand that the Arab precursors of Islam see themselves as children of Abraham, just as Jews and Christians do. You may remember the story in Genesis of Abraham and Hagar. Hagar, the handmaiden of Sarah, an Egyptian woman, by the way, young and beautiful, who was given as a proxy wife to Abraham in order for them to have an heir. And you remember the name of the heir? Found in, yes, the first line of Moby Dick, "Call me Ishmael." The stranger, the outsider, from the Jewish and Christian point of view. So then we have Nabi Ibrahim, as he's known to the Muslims, same word, of course, Abraham. And we have Abraham and Sarah. We have Abraham and Hagar, although we should put Hagar over here. It didn't turn out that way because of the opposition that developed between them. And then you recall that the product of the union was Ishmael, And the product later of the union of Abraham and Sarah in their extreme old age was Isaac. The Lord has heard. He laughed. Isaac is the chuckle, is the laugh, is the joke. Not in his humanity, but because you may remember that Sarah laughed in the tent when the messengers came and told Abraham, Abraham is really an old Arab sheikh out in front of his tent, and the wife and the women are in the back. They can always hear, and they still can in those situations. And they can see, but they can't be seen, and they shouldn't be heard. And Sarah laughed, shall I have pleasure in my old age? And she laughed, and Isaac is, in a sense, called the product of their laughter. Wonderful humor here, I think. It's a mature humor. And, well, you remember the Bible. The Bible then pairs Ishmael later with Rebecca, Rivka, in a very beautiful story, really idyllic. Isaac never was a great person in the sense that Abraham and Isaac or Jacob would be, but he was certainly a considerable person than Rebekah and Ishmael. Excuse me, I've got it wrong. I meant to put it over here. Rebekah and Isaac, and then they have Jacob. Jacob, is this correct?
Joseph is next.
Yeah, Jacob and the remarkable woman. Yeah. Jacob and Esau, who's a brother. And then Jacob married Rachel. It's Rachel in Hebrew, in Arabic. Right, Rachel, we call it. And then, of course, who do we have from them? Israel. Later we have Joseph and the tribes of Israel. The tribes, the sons of Israel, because Jacob's name, other name is Israel. The Bible doesn't continue being interested in Ishmael, except now and then you hear of the Ishmaelites coming out of the desert, maybe riding horses or camels. And it's the Ishmaelites who picked up Joseph when he was abandoned and took him to Egypt. But you see, the biblical tradition concentrates on this line. The Islamic tradition concentrates on this line because Ishmael is the link between Abraham and the Arabs. So what we have here is a kind of an extended family with a common father, but half brothers, you might say. And it's a remarkable notion. Abraham had another wife too, Keturah, and there are other children involved in the peopling of the Arabian Peninsula, according to legend. I'm not trying to suggest anything more than a mythic outline here, but myth often is more powerful than literal genealogy. I think in ancient Near Eastern times, as well as in New England, when people are trying to get into the Daughters of the American Revolution or something like that and want to find some way to trace their lineage back to the Revolutionary War or even back farther to the Mayflower. So this is why we can really speak of Father Abraham and Abrahamic traditions. Now, of course, the Jews came first, and then the Christians, and last, the Muslims. This might make Jews feel that they have the authoritative position of interpretation. Christians then may say, well, but we have the new dispensation, the new covenant in Christ, the new Adam, which would then go back to the beginnings by seeing Christ as the Logos or the Word. But the Muslims then will say, we're the last, but we are reaffirming the first, which has been lost in the two other traditions. I sometimes in class call the Islamic position a kind of theological end run around both the Christians and the Jews, because the Muslims believe that Islam originated with Abraham, actually with Adam, and that Islam, meaning submission, is the archetypal religion of humankind. Now, we can speak of generic Islam, and we can speak of brand name Islam. Brand name Islam, in the familiar sense to us, would be the Islam that was established because of the remarkable prophetic career of Muhammad in the 600s in Arabia. But generic Islam would be true religion, would be absolute submission to God. The Quran, and I will talk about the Quran a little bit later, the Quran, the recitation of the scripture of Islam, throughout emphasizes the priority of Abraham, who, it says, was neither a Jew nor a Christian, but a true monotheist, who was before. And the Quran also says that Muhammad is bringing nothing new that was not brought by Abraham and by Isaac and Ishmael and Jacob and Moses and Elias or Elijah and the prophets, it says, and Jesus and Muhammad. We make no distinction among them. So the Quran does see itself as being in the tradition of prophecy back to Abraham, but as restoring certain things that were lost or distorted in the intervening time. There is so much that's familiar to anybody reared in a biblical environment when you look at the Quran and you look at Islamic life. Arabia. Well, Arabia in Arabic is called Al-Jazira Al-Arabiya, which means the Arabian island. And this whole area is thought to be a kind of an island of a special people. The western part is higher elevation in general, and here this is higher elevation, and quite high elevation here. This area across here, and including here, the littoral, but also inland to some extent, is dry, but seasonally affected by the monsoons of the Indian Ocean and of East Africa. This area is quite dry, gets very little rainfall any time during the year. Terribly hot in the summer and spring and fall, but can be quite chilly in the winter. This region is called Hijaz, H-E-J-A-Z, and this is the cradle of Islam. Mecca is here, Medina about 280 miles to the north. These are the two great sanctuaries of Islam. Jeddah is the port. It's been there, of course, since antiquity, and still is one of the main cities of Arabia. The whole peninsula, with its largely pastoralist peoples before the time of Islam, did enjoy a high language, which was the language of poetry. We don't know how they ever achieved this language that was known across clan and tribal dialectal differences. But each clan and tribe also spoke its own dialect, which would often be quite different from others. The southern area of Yemen and Hadramaut, which is the geographical term, roughly this area, was quite different from Hijaz in that in antiquity, this was a high civilization with complex society and political patterns, royalty and hierarchy, and a very intricate agricultural irrigation system. Close relations with Mesopotamia, and many of the symbols are the same. Very different from here, which was much more nomadic. In the 500s, there were great conflicts between the Byzantine Christian Empire and the Persian Empire of the Achaemenids. At one point, the true cross, a great relic in Jerusalem, was stolen from Jerusalem by the Persians, enraging the Byzantines so that they launched a war which was to last many years. This is one of the reasons, very interesting reasons, why Mecca developed from a little outpost into a fairly rich and influential trading city, because these overland routes were cut off for a considerable period of time. So the trade, which was always very lucrative to the east and also to the spice areas here, as well as farther on into South and Southeast Asia, was interrupted through here. So the trade was diverted to the Red Sea, but representative navies of these two great powers in Ethiopia and in southern Arabia effectively shut off navigation because of the dangers of sailing. So these old trade routes through the Hejaz down to the land of Sheba, of frankincense, and so forth, became much more used. And across here, and from here across here. Much of the merchandise that would have gone that way came this way and returned by that way into the Mediterranean European markets, Roman markets, Byzantine, and so forth. Now, the only people who could handle trade through here were the people who lived there, the Arabs. Why is this? Partly because Arabs were so fierce. They're so dangerous. The Romans never succeeded in subjugating any sizable part of Arabia. They could clank in with their legions and never be heard of again. Logistical problems are unbelievable. The harshness of the terrain, the sun, the lack of water, and the ravening Bedouin, who just don't care. I mean, they will die, but they will go out and they will just dismantle any outside group that comes in. They learned to do this very early with the careful, brilliant manipulation of the horse and the camel. Now, you can raise horses in practically any part of the world, except the Antarctic, I suppose, and the Arctic. But you can't raise camels just anywhere. And not just anybody can raise camels. You have to live with camels, it seems. So there's a certain symbiosis almost that developed between the camel breeding Bedouins out in their steppe areas. The Bedouin never lived in the desert. Nobody can live in the desert. But they lived in steppe areas, which would have seasonal rain and seasonal grass and flowers and so forth. And the camel came to be the single most valuable object in the whole inventory of Arabian economy. This area had been a sanctuary and an important commercial center. An oligarchy developed here, which extended its sway north and south and was able, through money and through coercion, to subjugate or to co-opt smaller tribal groups all the way up and down the trade route. This was the only center that could really guarantee secure passage. And this center is far enough away from the great powers to pretty much dictate its own terms. Now, what were the ancient Arabs like? Well, they reproduce an awful lot. They've always been highly sexed. They talk about it themselves in their poetry and to this day. The desert has always produced an enormous number of people who have provided recruits for the more sedentary, civilized areas. In fact, we think, although we're not sure, that a lot of the people who developed civilization here came from the desert. Now, one of the things is, it seems that natural selection, now that we know something about Darwinianism, played a role in this. And also the isolation of groups where they could develop hardy strains. Very independent, very proud, with honor foremost above all. The Bedouin pastoralist types of peoples have always tended to despise settled peoples, and especially farmers or anybody who lives from the soil. This goes back to Cain and Abel. If you want to look at a pattern, a mythic pattern, in Genesis itself, the one who brings the first fruits and then the one who brings the animals of the range. The Arabs would prefer always the pastoralist. There are many sayings of Muhammad, for example, which seem to disparage agriculture. Once he saw a plow out in the alleyway and said to a friend of his, "One will never find something like that in a house of one of my followers." Again, that tremendous sense of being superior and over and master of nature. And master of people who live on the soil. Now, I don't want to turn this into some sort of general theory, because Islam also has many sayings in favor of agriculture, obviously. I mean, we must eat. But I'm just giving you something of the more primitive, wild, desert, Bedouin attitude. I could also share sayings of Muhammad in favor of agriculture, but I think that you would know that in most religious traditions you have a lot of sayings of founders and heroes which have been collected from many sources and attributed to the hero himself, which does tell us a lot about attitudes of the community. It may not give us too much reliable information about the founder, into whose mouth many words have been put, but that does give something of an old Arabian attitude. The Arabs lived in close kinship groups, the family, the clan, and the tribe. And beyond the tribe was no man's land, was other, was foreigner, was alien. Blood purity was extremely important. They cultivated the genealogies assiduously. Honor, ird, I-R-D, was the most valuable possession next to camels, I suppose. And for a man's honor to be called into question, that was the most deadly affair possible. And honor could often be besmirched most effectively through the women attached to a kinship group. So women were guarded, women were watched, women were distrusted, and little girls were frequently buried alive when they were born. Some anthropologists have suggested that this was for economic reasons, just as you'll find it among classical Eskimos sometimes, the exposure of female babies. There may be something to that, because there sometimes was not enough food to go around. But also there seems to be a fair amount of evidence that fathers feared that if their daughters were allowed to grow up, they might be a means of bringing dishonor to the name of the family. Muhammad later was to fight vigorously against the killing of daughters. And the Quran itself points it out as one of the most horrible things that humans have ever descended to. He was a staunch reformer in that respect. But there was this great sense of honor. There was also a strong belief in in hospitality and manliness. Let me just put a couple of terms on the board for you here. Hospitality, manliness, chivalry, you might almost call it. First we have honor, ird. Then we have muruwa, which is like the Latin word virtus, from which we get virility, machismo. It's really what it is. And then we have the law of retaliation, the lex talionis, the law of retaliation, which includes the vendetta, that is, blood spilled in one tribe has to be balanced by a death in the perpetrating side. It doesn't have to be the person who actually did the murder, but somebody of equal value. So the law of retaliation, in the absence of any written law or stable code, the sheikh, that is the gray-haired one, the aged one, that's really what sheikh means. It's somebody over 50, presumably wise, because old, in an age-graded society, not having read King Lear, perhaps, who complained that he was old before he was wise. So the sheikh was the first among equals, the primus inter pares, as the Latins used to put it, the first among equals, who would, at his tent, assemble other older men, and like a Plains American Indian chieftain, lead by not leading. That is, through his moral power, through his example, but not through any election and the modern sense, and not through any governmental structure. The sheikh would be able to distribute booty, for example, from raids, because he was entitled to one-fourth of all of the booty that was gained in a raid. The Arabs did like to raid a great deal, and that was economically important as well. But it was important because, as Philip Hetty, the late professor of Arabic studies at Princeton, put it in his History of the Arabs, raiding was a kind of national sport. There was killing, and there was a great deal of violence, but there was also show of valor and of skill, martial skill. And not all that many people died normally in a raid, because what you did was to bring superior forces to bear upon inferior forces. So there was no loss of face in the defeated group, just the loss of camels and women and whatever else might have been available. The camel was the long-range bomber, the strategic bomber, which they would ride for sometimes hundreds of miles, because the camel can go tremendous distances. And the horse was the short-range attack fighter plane, or the interceptor, because the horse would be towed along, you know, without a rider, and a horse can go a long way without tiring out or becoming lame if he doesn't have a burden on him. And then in the early morning, the dawn raiders would strike on horseback and then return to some valley where the camels were hidden, and then they would return to their area. We have then honor, we have manliness, we have the law of retaliation, we have the sheikh, who has a kind of a rough social welfare system. We have the razia, or the raid. We have also the jahl notion. The jahl means barbarity. This is not a virtue, but a reality. Jahl means ignorance, but it also means barbarousness. It can be tolerated in a young man who is feeling his oats and is showing that he can lick anybody in the house. Jahl is the kind of senseless barbarity that you sometimes find in a man because he just enjoys beating people up or killing them. Not for any reason, not because he's been incited to it, but just because of the joy of mayhem. And that is a streak that some people have. It's a mean streak. This whole period of pre-Islamic Arabia, let's say 100 to 150 years before the work of Muhammad, came to be called by Islamic times Al-Jahiliya, the age of barbarism, taking it from this term which described the real crazy, the one who just wanted to have sword play and to beat people up. But there were also other virtues, and the greatest was hilm. And I'll put that in my value system above irid, which is honor. Hilm is rare anytime, and it was rare and greatly to be desired in pre-Islamic Arabia. Hilm means forbearance. It is not agape. It is not love. It's the forbearance of the superior toward the weaker, toward the inferior. It's the forbearance of the strong, silent man when confronted with the barbarian. The barbarian may insult the strong, silent man, may kick dirt in his face, may hurt him badly with weapons. But the strong, forbearing man of hilm is able to retaliate drastically, but does not, and is not called a coward because of it. You can't fake it. It is the superiority of the superior, of the really morally powerful as well as physically powerful. This comes to be transferring from Jahiliyyah times, and it's the only really highly admirable trait that I find in the whole inventory of virtues and values. This comes to be one of the names of God in Islam, God who has hilm. God the Halim, as it's called, the forbearing. Al-Halim. God, it is believed, has 99 most beautiful names, and one of them is Al-Halim. W. Montgomery Watt, the Scottish biographer of Muhammad, has referred to these various points as a whole as tribal humanism. This was the real value system of ancient Arabia, he said. It was tribal, kinship, blood was stronger than anything else, and it was humanistic in the sense that humans were at the center. But there were beliefs in spirits and gods, And there was a belief in one overarching God who was called the God. Now, this God, El means the, and Elah is God. But when it's called the God, it becomes, in our sense, God, the one God. For most of the Jahiliyyah people, Al-Ilah, which is then contracted to Allah, Al-Ilah, Allah really was the supreme God, the supreme being. But supreme being belief is not the same thing as monotheism. It's merely the top with a hierarchy of gods and goddesses and other spirits. I'm indebted to Raffaele Petizzoni's work on the nature of monotheism for my own remarks on that, and I think he's quite right. Petizzoni, who died 20 or so years ago in Italy, argued that the only true monotheisms are the ones that we find introduced by remarkable individuals, prophets. And the mark of a monotheism is not a philosophical monism, as you might find in certain types of Brahmanical Hinduism, or in supreme beingism, because you have supreme beings in many world groups from prehistoric times, but rather a prophet who brings a message of an absolutely jealous and vengeful God who will not brook any equals or any rivals, certainly not any equals. Now, one quickly goes to a more sophisticated understanding of that, but if you do look at some of the historical development which becomes monotheism, just looking at the biblical record, you do find a very jealous God. And it could be argued that the God idea at the time of Moses is not monotheistic either. To say it's monotheistic is to read back later, more theologized notions of monotheism. That doesn't need to occupy us too much right now, but I leave that with you because it's a good topic for discussion. And then we can also discuss whether it's necessary to have one God. The Abrahamists have always insisted that it's essential. Not only is it necessary, it is the case that there is one God. So, we have Allah, but we have also others. There were three daughters of Allah who were highly regarded. There was another divinity named Hubal, who was closely associated with Mars. And in all, in Mecca, by the time of Muhammad, there were some 360 deities represented in the Kaaba, the great temple, which was believed to have been built by Abraham. That perhaps you have seen, I'll show you pictures of it a little later. The Kaaba doesn't have to have an H on the back. This simply means cubical structure. Now, there were certain spiritual leaders in ancient Arabia. One was called the Kahin. You can compare it to the Jewish notion of Kohen or Kohen. The Kahin was a seer, very much like a shaman, who was able to experience self-induced trance. Mircea Eliade always says that a shaman is a shaman because he or she can induce trance in himself or herself. But not everybody can induce trance in themselves. They may experience trance induced by another, but a shaman can control the trance and can have out-of-body experiences and can find lost objects and can accompany souls, either lost souls back to their body. Often in shamanic societies, illness is thought to be a loss of soul force. Among Eskimos and circumpolar peoples, Indians and so forth, you find this. But the Kahin could do some of these things, and he wasn't a priest with parishioners. He was more of a professional with clients, which a shaman or a diviner often is. He could also cast lots, and he used arrows of different types in divining by throwing them down, more like the I Ching, I suppose, than anything here, and could, by their arrangements, divine the future and divine mysteries. The Kahin, and then we have also the Sha'ir. This simply means one who knows. the knower, but in the sense of a Gnostic, the sense of one who knows the hidden things, the mysterious things. This word is translated, interestingly, as poet. It's thought that the poet had a muse, a spirit, a kind of Satan, a shaitan, which isn't necessarily bad in ancient Arabian demonology, or a genie, who was able to come into the consciousness of the poet and enlighten the poet and give the poet powers. Then we also have some knowledge of nabis, who are prophets, and this is exactly the same word as the Hebrew, nabi, a prophet, one to whom a god has spoken, or God, Allah. The poet had very great influence because poetry was the only real art form of the pastoralist Arabs. I think that you're familiar with the ancient Semitic idea of the power of words, that blessings and curses really were efficacious. I think always of the story of how Rachel and Jacob contrived to steal Esau's birthright from old Isaac with the ruse of the smelly fur that was put on Jacob, because Esau was a wild and woolly man who was out and hunting, and Jacob had always stayed close to Mama in the kitchen. And Jacob, the second born of the twins, with Rachel, cheated and got the blessing. But once the blessing was given, even though it was through a cheating transaction, it was the blessing. This view is very much a part of ancient Arabia. The poet, if he was in favor of somebody, could help somebody greatly. Not by blessing as a priest might bless, but just by giving through the magic of language a character reference or memorable descriptions or names. But if the poet was against somebody, through diatribe and through satire, could ruin a person in memory. So people always rejoiced when a poet was born to them. And you know when a poet is born to you, when the blarney starts coming, you know, that sort of thing, and the power. And they were women as well as men. There was a special type of poem called a qasida, or an ode, which was a standard form. Almost always starts out with the lamenting of a lost love and the loss of youth, and the remembering of the wonderful romantic or platonic, however it might have been, relationships. Then usually the praising of one's camel or one's horse. And it points, you can find just as much a wonder and joy in camel flesh as in woman's flesh in the poems. So we have the swelling breasts and the hips like sand dunes and the taut bellies and the narrow ankles and the long black tresses and the teeth like pearls of the lady love and the breath like musk. But then the camel with all of his wonderful wrinkles and the ears and the hollow of the eyes and the legs like great oak trees and being able to run across the desert and so forth. After he finished with the camel, he would then describe the saddle and all of the tack. Then after that, something of nature, flocks running up and down the hills in the afternoon, or a desert thunderstorm, which is really frightening sometimes, with the black clouds coming and the lightning and the flash flood. And then later, praise for the patron, signing off with a little bread and butter letter and hope for more bread and butter later on. So this is the ode. There are so many of them that have come down to us. Such a narrowly constricted genre, but full of the most amazing inventiveness. And of course, each year when there were bardic contests near Mecca, people coming from all over Western Arabia at least to compete, you would find the old things being said in arresting new ways, and people would remember them. Mostly people were illiterate, Arabic had not been perfected as a written language by this time. It was not until after the Quran inspired mass literacy that the writing system came to be perfected. It was written in a crude form, and the winning poems each year were taken and hung up in a group in the Kaaba, in the temple, which gives you some sense of their prestige, the prestige of language, the prestige of symbolic communication. With this narrow form, you have to reach out and find new words and new metaphors and new similes, and this is why the study of ancient Arabian poetry is so demanding.